This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The bird flu is in the news again this week in about three different ways. First, in a made-for-TV movie, Fatal Contact: Bird Flu in America. It's a fictional account of a bird flu strain that mutates to pass easily between people. The disease spreads around the world, eventually killing 18 million, and the film focuses on efforts in the U.S. to control the deadly outbreak. How close is this scenario to a real pandemic? Well, we're going to talk to flu experts about the film, what it got right, perhaps what it missed. Also, how should we handle a real outbreak is the second flu story. Phase two of the U.S. federal flu plan, which is a blueprint for dealing with a flu outbreak, perhaps like the one in the movie, was released last week. We'll talk about that, too. And finally, the third story deals with a paper out in today's issue of the journal Science, and it questions our assumptions about who should be vaccinated first should a flu pandemic break out. Now, most people have said that the old and the sick should be vaccinated before the young and the healthy, but this paper says just the opposite. One of the co-authors is here to make the case for this vaccination strategy. So there's a lot to talk about. If you'd like to talk about it with us, you're more than welcome. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Michael Osterholm is the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy, professor in the School of Public Health, University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. He joins us from KNOW in St. Paul. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Osterholm.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
Good afternoon to you. William Karish is the director of the Field Veterinary Program at the Wildlife Conservation Society in the Bronx, New York, and he joins us today by phone from his office. Welcome to the program, Dr. Karish.
Well, thank you, sir. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. Dr. Osterholm, you saw the movie. How would you rate it? Thumbs up, thumbs down, thumbs sideways?
Thumbs sideways. I think that there were a number of aspects of the movie which are true to what would happen during a moderate to severe influenza pandemic, but there are also several scenes that were really over the top. And as a citizen, it would be hard for you to understand or interpret which of those were over the top and which were real that might be expected to happen.
Well, give me an example of what was over the top.
Well, a couple of them. First of all, there's a scene in the movie where we see a series of headlights of various numbers of trucks driving up a hill, and then as you get to the top of the hill, it's almost a scene out of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And at that point, you see these dump trucks pulling up to this football-sized hole of about 35 feet in depth, dumping bodies out of the back of a dump truck. And these are human bodies, of course. And then you see a bulldozer in there basically putting dirt over the top of them. That would never happen like that, even though we will have issues around mortuary science aspects and corpse management. None of us anticipate that. That's enough, I think, to turn people over to think, oh, my God, how bad this could be. One other scene is at the very end of the movie where there's now this anticipated second wave of the pandemic. In this case, it's occurring in Angola, Africa, and you see the CDC personnel coming on site, and by the time the picture turns around through a hut and then into the village itself, you see these hundreds of bodies lying there in the ground, blood covered, as if they all died, leaving people at the very end of the movie with the sense that the second wave was going to wipe out humankind. Neither of those are true or even possible.
Mm-hmm. But the movie scenario itself, which is, let me give a brief synopsis. There's an American businessman who's infected in Hong Kong. And after a drink at the airport bar, he flies back to Richmond, Virginia, makes it to his son's Little League game before he starts exhibiting any symptoms. And that's by then he's spread the virus in all of those places. Realistic scenario.
That's realistic in the sense that, as we know, with influenza, one is infectious for up to a day before you actually have symptoms. The part about how much of transmission would have occurred at the bar from the napkin and the olive that was touched and so forth is more speculative. Clearly, the primary mechanism for transmitting influenza virus is really close contact in terms of 3 or 4 feet away and breathing. We also believe that, of course, aerosols or additional air transmission, which could be many feet away, can also occur. But on a whole, that is a realistic issue and one, again, that would score more the thumbs up perspective in that, as we saw with SARS and we have with so many other respiratorily transmitted infectious agents, we live in this age today of global travel, and viruses do not respect geographic boundaries or time zones. And in this case, an exotic disease of some other area of the world will very quickly go around the world, and that is a concern we have with influenza.
Yeah, and if I could jump in at this moment, certainly the brief scenes of wild birds or migratory birds taking flight, you know, leaves the public with this impression that that's the most likely way this very highly pathogenic or deadly form is going to spread around the world. But in fact, you know, most likely it's going to, if it becomes very infectious and can spread from person to person, it's going to be where the disease is located now, and then it might end up coming, or most likely come with humans in an airplane to here, and not with a few wild birds that are most likely going to die along their migration route.
Well, we kept hearing that this is, you know, wild birds are the likely vectors of spreading the flu around.
Well, wild birds are the natural host of the normal avian influenza viruses, which don't cause mortality and don't cause effects in people. And what has been happening over, I mean, this has been circulating in poultry for the last 7 years and has not really gotten into wild birds coming to North America. So it's had 7 years of opportunity to do that. It looks like it spilled over into some wild birds in China about a year ago, and spread at least regionally. We found it in Mongolia in wild birds in an expedition. But we can't link it really clearly to migratory birds in these outbreaks in Africa and other places. It doesn't seem to persist. So what we're speculating, or the most probable thing that's going on, is the illegal movement, the smuggling of poultry or contaminated equipment is moving it around and then infecting wild birds locally or regionally, and then it tends to go away. So we're not seeing migratory birds bringing it back to Europe from Africa now. There's no evidence that migratory birds took it to Africa, and the likelihood of it coming to the U.S. in wild birds is slim. So there's still that, what Dr. Elstrom was just saying, that global transport allows a rapid mechanism, so airplanes and shipping of materials. So maybe it'll come into North America with some shipments and once again infect wild birds, or maybe it'll come in as a human disease on an airplane with a passenger, or maybe illegal smuggled goods into South America and get established there. We don't know what direction it might come now with global transport.
Ira, I think one of the really important points here, and I think Dr. Hirsch is really hitting on it, is that the public remains quite confused about what we're talking about here, i.e. the bird flu and then this idea of a pandemic. And I think it's really important to distinguish what's happening now is largely a disease of birds. As Billy pointed out, primarily in the domestic poultry world with some spillover into the wild birds. What we're concerned about from a human pandemic is at the point where that virus continues to change genetically, whether it's through a mutation or a reassortment, which is not significant to the public's mind. It's just that the virus changes, and then it becomes a person-to-person transmitted agent. And then at that point, it's kind of that old idea, it's about the birds, but it's no longer about the birds. And I think that's an important message, is that we're not at that threshold yet. What we're concerned about is getting to that threshold of where it then would become a person-to-person transmitted agent. So right now, this issue of the birds, while it's very important, it's not the threat right now of everyone around the world becoming infected, even if the virus should make it here to the United States.
As we get...
And I think people really do need to understand that there's two somewhat separate issues, and one is trying to control or prevent this disease before it turns into a human pandemic form, which would be eradicating the disease in poultry. And then some really good planning and preparedness in case it does happen and it gets into people and starts traveling around the world. I mean, it's very almost a branched or two-tiered approach, and both of those things have to be dealt with effectively.
Let's talk a bit a few minutes we have before the break, and we'll continue after the break, about the Phase 2 plan that the administration came up with last week. Michael, can you sort of summarize that for us, what the good points and the shortcomings were?
Well, the plan really is a living document, and I wouldn't want anyone to think after hearing about it today that this is the final plan. I look at where our federal government was 18 to 24 months ago, and it's the old adage, you creep, you walk, you run, and I think we're walking at a much faster pace. 18, 24 months ago, we were hardly creeping. But the plan really begins to draw into place a whole series of preparedness activities that have to be conducted at the federal level, at the state and local level, involving the private sector, involving vaccine use, involving health care. But there's a long ways to go yet. One of the things that the plan doesn't provide, for example, is resources, and that was not the intent of the plan. That's obviously the executive branch and the Congress getting together. But we're still putting a lot of our preparedness activities together on a shoestring. When I say that, putting $1 billion into flu vaccine is a lot of money on one hand. On the other hand, when you look at the potential impact of a pandemic of influenza tomorrow, which would be on a worldwide basis in the trillions of dollars, it's that idea of, you know, what do you pay as insurance or whatever. And so I think that, let me just say that I think this is a good start. I think that this issue has the attention of the highest levels in our government. I think Secretary Mike Leavitt at the Department of Health and Human Services has been very clear how important this is. I think he's gone out to every state or almost every state in the nation now to talk to local communities about this. So we've got a long ways to go, but it's surely coming.
Is there a section for making sure the pandemic might not spread from bird to bird in the U.S.?
Well, in terms of spreading bird to bird, again, the United States has one of the best plans in place of anywhere in the world in terms of trying to deal with this virus infection in poultry. And I think Dr. Resch can talk more about that. But in that sense, we have that. What we're more concerned about is if the virus gets into wild birds, it gets into some of the poultry flocks in this country, which are not kept in what we call biosecurity areas or biosecurity barns, and we do have a number of outdoor backdoor flocks. And Billy, you may want to talk about that in terms of the implications.
Right. Doctor, hold on there, Dr. Karras, because we're going to take a short break and come back and talk more about this and get your views about containing any outbreak among birds here, if it should happen, and what the plan might be for that. So stay with us. We'll be right back with Michael Osterholm and William Karras after this break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about avian flu, including the made-for-TV movie Fatal Contact, which was, I think it was on ABC this week. Our number 1-800-989-8255. My guests are Michael Osterholm, Director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy, Professor in the School of Public Health, University of Minnesota, Minneapolis, William Karras, Director of the Field Veterinary Program at the Wildlife Conservation Society in Bronx, New York. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Dr. Karras, tell us about any plan that you think should have some, at least part of the plan, to control how the birds are separated or keep the virus from spreading from one bird to another?
Yes, absolutely, and I think the U.S. model is a great one. And we've had high-path avian influenza outbreaks in the U.S. over the last few years, and they're very quickly snuffed out because the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the state associations and also private industry are very on top of this. So they have good diagnostics, they have good training, they have very quick response, and when there's those outbreaks in chickens in the U.S., they're controlled within a matter of a week or two, and they just don't get any further. And that kind of approach is what's needed over in Asia and in Africa. So it's something we can export, is that kind of expertise and knowledge to control it. Because the human infections, unfortunately, there's just been a confirmed case of a person that died in Mali, and that's the first human that's died in sub-Saharan Africa, and it's linked to infected chickens. So they found it in chickens and then in a person. So every one of those human infections that comes from a chicken is another opportunity for this virus to get established in people, to mutate or change or reform itself to become deadly in humans. So there's that upstream approach. If we can eliminate that contact with the disease between people and chickens, we're going to reduce the risk of a pandemic. So it's like pulling cards out of a deck and finally getting the ace of spades. I mean, it's about a numbers game, and the gambling industry in this country certainly understands what the odds are. So we're talking about playing the odds. Mm-hmm. So we really want to reduce the infection in birds, and understand more about how wild birds might be moving it around. So like I mentioned before, that's one of the parallel tracks, is to reduce the risk of it becoming pandemic in humans. And then the other track is really get geared up. And as Dr. Osterholm was just saying, the plan has really come along in the U.S., which is beautiful, but that's not the signal for everybody to go back to sleep and become complacent. We still have a lot of work to do, and it's a serious issue.
Let's talk about what the federal government needs to do to curb the spread of the disease. Do you have to really clamp down on the borders and watch birds that come into this country?
Absolutely. I think, you know, the potential for smuggling, and it's just one more border security issue. We've had seen some confiscated chicken products have come into the U.S. There's the illegal bird trade for the pet trade, which is huge.
Right.
Another disease, Newcastle's disease, came in a few years ago, was smuggled in with some fighting cocks into California. And that doesn't cause a big disease in humans, but it cost over $100 million of taxpayer dollars to control it. And that was just a few birds slipping through the border there between Mexico and California. So, and the whole world needs to be geared up for this. So once again, we see the migratory bird things as almost as a red herring, that you almost focus on it too much and ignore border patrols and good port security, and that's more likely how it's going to spread around the world.
I had seen some news articles that the birds isolated, you know, in quarantine at airports were found to have them, birds coming in, you know, in luggage.
Yeah, that's right. That's happened in Europe twice. In Belgium, they found infected wild birds being smuggled, and also birds legally imported to England were tested in quarantine. So if it's being done legally, we'll have a good chance. The USDA quarantine system, once again, is very good, and they'll probably pick it up. But just like the illegal trade in wildlife is much like the drug trade, the illegal drug trade, and it's very hard to get a handle on the exact numbers and where it's going. And the economic value is second only to the illegal drug trade, is the illegal trade in wildlife. So there's some attention to be paid to that, too.
Ira,
Yes, go ahead, Michael.
I was going to say, one of the issues that we have to acknowledge to the public and even to ourselves as scientists is that there's a lot more that we don't know that we need to know, and I think in some cases assume that we do know. For example, there was a sense that, in fact, H5N1 would not be a problem in migratory or wild birds, given the long history of infection in Southeast Asia, meaning of at least 5 to 7 years duration, where it was more widespread. And then all of a sudden, as Dr. Esch indicated, we saw this flare-up in China early last year, and then suddenly we saw migratory birds that were infected. And then I think the pendulum did swing way over to the other side of where it was all about migratory birds. And I think the truth is that clearly, as has been laid out, poultry play a very important role, and there's much more movement of poultry around the world than anyone has ever understood, even to those poorest of countries like in Africa. But I think at the same time, while there have been predictions made how migratory birds would bring to the United States, and now we're seeing less infection in Europe, and there's some question here, I would worry that we swing too far the other way now and say, well, migratory birds don't play any role. And I think what this is really calling for is much more in the way of support for understanding about bird viruses in general, and what do we know about how they move, how they don't move, what might be candidate species that would carry this virus and not show symptoms, or those that might show symptoms but survive, those that would die. And one of the things the public's asking us right now is for more information about what role birds play, and I think we need to really support much more in the way of research. And I think some of the work that Dr. Karish and others have done has really been important. And frankly, they need a lot more support right now so that we can better understand this and help give the public a sense of what's going on.
Yeah, I certainly appreciate that plug there. And we understand, you know, what we have learned for over the last 30 or 40 years of avian influenza in poultry is there's multiple routes of this disease spreading, and all of those have to be addressed simultaneously. So what Mike was just saying about a balanced approach is really essential, because if we just ignore one, focus on two or three routes of spread and ignore one, we're not going to accomplish anything. Mm-hmm. Over years and years, last decades of looking at wild birds and diseases, we find unusual and strange things all the time. We don't even know what they mean. We found some coronaviruses, which has been the same type of virus that causes intestinal infections in people, and it's linked to SARS. We don't know what they mean. So a lot there are still a lot of mysteries. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, every day when you go outside, people are dealing and around birds all the time and don't have a problem. So there's a lot to learn, and at the same time, there's no reason to get scared or of being around animals, of course.
Dr. Karas, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us. I know you got to run. Thank you. William Karas is director of the Field Veterinary Program at the Wildlife Conservation Society in the Bronx. I want to bring up another guest on now who really has a controversial paper that's published out in the journal Science, and it's about who should get vaccinated if you have a limited supply of vaccine. And the paper out in today's issue suggests a new strategy for vaccinating against the flu in the event of a pandemic. And it really goes against the widely accepted notion that after those on the front lines of battles are vaccinated, maybe the doctors and the emergency people, then the old and the sick people should be next. This paper, though, says instead of that, the younger, healthier adults and adolescents should get the vaccines first. And joining me now to talk about it, about his plan, is Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, chair of the Department of Clinical Bioethics at the Clinical Center of the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda. Welcome to the program, Dr. Emanuel.
Thank you for having me.
Why this reversal? Give us your thinking here.
Well, I'm not sure it's a reversal so much as I don't think that the original proposal is mm-hmm. necessarily either ethically or scientifically that sound. From the ethical standpoint, why would you give the vaccine to people who are older at most risk of dying? We have a lot of allocation principles or reason or justifications for rationing in different situations, and it's not always to save the most lives. Sometimes the sickest people go to the top of the list for, say, organ transplants. I think it's actually a widespread intuition of most people that they would rather invest their resources to try to live out a full life rather than invest more money at 65 to live another 15 or 20 or 30 or 40 years. And it's that idea that we mm-hmm. draw on. And I think it's actually a very widespread idea. And mm-hmm. if you follow that idea that you'd want to spend more money or concentrate your resources on people 15 to 20 or 40 to make sure they live a full lifespan, then you should give priority to them. I mean, that seems to me to be the right reason. The previous idea of giving to the old and the sick seems to me, based upon annual flu planning and not pandemic planning.
Interesting. Dr. Osterholm, how do you react to that?
Well, first of all, I want to congratulate Dr. Emanuel. I think it was a very thoughtful, courageous, and wise piece of work, and I think it really goes to the heart of an issue that very few people understand in terms of our current pandemic preparedness. On a worldwide basis today, we can make enough vaccine on an annual flu season basis to basically vaccinate about 300 million people. That's all the pipes, the plumbing, the machines, the factories that we have to make vaccine. We just can't make a lot more. We're working to try to make somewhat more, but it's not going to be a lot more. Well, along comes the H5N1 virus, which, again, we don't know will be the next pandemic strain, but if it were, we find that it takes much more vaccine dose to actually protect someone using even our current vaccine, which, again, just remind people, we're working with the current strain of the flu virus, H5N1. If it were to become the pandemic strain, it would undergo more changes, and we'd have to basically start all over again, in a sense, to actually make the pandemic vaccine at the time that that virus change occurred. But we expect the principles of how it grows and how it is accepted in people to be about the same. So we need much more of the vaccine dose at to vaccinate people, anywhere from 6 to 12 times as much. We've learned in recent weeks that also the yields in growing this virus in chicken eggs has been much below that of what we'd normally expect to see with H3N2, anywhere from only 10 to 50% of the growth. When you add up those two sets of numbers, we will be very fortunate on a worldwide basis if in the first year of a pandemic we'll have enough vaccine to vaccinate 25 to 40 million people worldwide out of 6.5 billion. So this idea of allocation is not just a money issue. And I think that what Dr. Emanuel's work is doing is it's forcing us now to say
what are we going to do with this very precious resource that will be in extreme short supply under a very, very emotionally challenging time? We need to think about that now. So I think his work was very important, and I really applaud it being out there, and I think that we need to take it to heart and look carefully at what we're going to do with this limited amount of vaccine.
Can I emphasize, pick up on one point there?
Sure.
There's a lot of people say, well, you know, we don't need so much planning now or discussion now about who to allocate. We'll look at who's getting sick and who's dying from the vaccine, and then we'll make plans based upon what's happening. I think that's, you know, a lot of times us ethicists are accused of being unrealistic. I think that's very unrealistic. If we really have a pandemic, it is going to be pandemonium in the country, and communication is going to be difficult. Furthermore, people have to accept the grounds on which you're allocating as legitimate, as acceptable. They have to have debated and discussed it beforehand, and you're not going to be able to change it at the last minute, informing every state health department and then down to every county where they're distributing it. You have to have a plan that is widely implemented, that is widely known, accepted by the public, accepted by the people who are going to implement it. This can't be something you change at the very last minute as if you have perfect communication and you're dealing with 5 or 10 people. So I think the debate now is going to be very important, and I think what we've just heard also emphasizes that, you know, in the United States we only have one production facility for flu vaccine. That doesn't seem adequate in my, I think in most people's view, if you actually ask them, does that seem like a reasonable precaution to take for this potential?
All right, let me remind everybody that this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. But what are the options there for, let's, you know, for getting more production? You seem to be saying we could do more production if we really wanted to.
Well, let me just add, first of all, that what we're using right now for our production capacity is really a 1950s technology with one additional improvement upon it. And the NIH is now funding a number of different groups to look at what we'd call a next-level technology, growing basically the same kind of virus in cell culture so we could grow more of it. And what one of the issues, though, that we all have to come to grips with is that the ability to create a new bullet is only part of the solution, that magic bullet. It's also you have to have the gun to fire it from. And today we do not have the worldwide vaccine production capacity because the private sector has largely avoided getting into this area for a whole lot of reasons, primarily that it's not a financially rewarding area to get into. And so even if we have a new vaccine, Ira, it doesn't mean we can produce it for the world. And I might add that although we tend to be American-centric on this issue, saying that we need to get our country protected and vaccinated, what we have to understand is that with this global just-in-time economy that we live in, we have a need to vaccinate the world. Today, 80% of all the drugs we use in this country, all the vaccines and drugs combined for cancer, for antibiotics, all these things come from offshore. You look at parts of our food supply, look at many essential products and services that we use in this country. They originate offshore. And so if a pandemic were to wipe through the world, and even if we had more vaccine available to us and could minimize its impact here, the collateral damage to the United States of America would be huge during a pandemic. And so what we have to do is move to better vaccines, and we have to, as a world, and not just the United States, I think this is a G8 issue, it's one of an insurance policy that I can't imagine is more important, and we have to find a way to create the kind of vaccine production capacity and then the distribution and delivery system. If we don't, we will pay one hell of a price in what I would consider a worldwide Katrina.
I have about a minute left, Dr. Emanuel. The idea of giving the vaccine to people aged 13 to 40 instead of the elders, you say this is the best way to maximize the result of a pandemic, something we would not think about as a regular flu vaccine.
Right. I think there are two justifications. One is an ethical justification, which I've given you. I think
right.
giving people the opportunity to live through a life. Another is a practical consideration. Just imagine what happens if you bet wrong and say it's W-shaped like the 1918 and the biggest mortality rate is a 20 to 40-year-old, and you've given the vaccine to people over 65. You now have had your major catastrophe in 20 to 40-year-olds. Say you bet the other way and you give your vaccine to 20 to 40-year-olds and it turns out to be more U-shaped and the higher mortality or at risk is in the older people. Well, we know compared to annual flu.
Doctor, I've got to wrap it up. I think you've made the point, but we've run out of time. I want to say goodbye to both of you, Michael Osterholm and Ezekiel Emanuel. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Have a good weekend. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk about a new play. Actually, it's not that new, but it's opened in New York, about the ethics of race and science. So stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.